When Joe Biden was still president, the pressure to insist that he was as fit as a fiddle and as sharp as a tack led Democrats to prop up a fatally unpopular president. Much of the media was rightly seen as complicit in that project. Journalism is not immune to such corruptions. The fear of offending one's readers or viewers drives more media bias and self-censorship than ideology does. Columnist Jonah Goldberg wrote that on February 28, 2025, about the complicity of the media in distorting the truth or outright lying when reporting the news. Whatever happened to the days when members of the press were objective and factual? Turns out, they never were. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Catherine J. Magar, the professor of journalism and mass communications at the UW-Madison and author of City of Newsmen, Public Lies and Professional Secrets in Cold War Washington, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2022, and welcomes University of the Air.
Thank you for having me.
I have to admit that my assumption, at least in childhood, was that when you tuned in the news, if it was Walter Cronkite or somebody else, that this is the fact. There's objectivity here, and these are ideas that you can live by. You're saying
That's a very common misconception. In fact, there are two misconceptions I think that a lot of us have about the press in the 1940s and 1950s, maybe a little into the 1960s, and they somewhat contradict each other. And one is sort of the one that you had, that the press used to be more reliable and they just gave you the facts and they used to be trustworthy and now they're not. And then we've also got this other story that maybe is more popular, you know, among media historians, that, well, they were just stenographers for the government. And they, you know, they never pushed back on their sources and they were all cozy with everyone in the government and they were all elite, sort of like Joseph Alsop, a famous elite columnist. And that's not quite true either. And so I was trying to complicate that story a little bit, really looking on the ground into these lives of these reporters in Washington.
Maybe a little sidebar to that before we really get launched is the interview. I'm not talking about, you know, news anchor, but actually somebody like Edward R. Murrow interviewing somebody in government and not pressing them, you're saying? Not questioning what they're saying?
Yes, actually, sometimes they would, a reporter would try to do a profile or, you know, a prestigious interview like a Murrow interview on some subject to curry favor with that subject. And that wasn't always looked on favorably by the Home Office. So, you know, especially like the New York Times had a really large, one of the largest Washington bureaus of any newspaper in this period. But it's not a Washington paper. And so there were always fights in these memos and cables going back and forth between the New York office, which is saying, you know, you can't do this. It makes you look like you're in the pocket of so-and-so. And the reporter saying, I thought you wanted me to have access to so-and-so. And so I need to do this complimentary profile of them to be able to get that news. And so there's a lot of tension in this period on sort of how to curry favor with government sources on whom they relied.
If we go back earlier for a minute to the time before your book covers, which is to say the 40s and forward, if we go back to the early days of the 20th century, that term yellow journalism we're familiar with, where anything to sell a story, whether it was true or not, but somehow things have evolved past that into a different kind of not entirely reliable journalism.
I think that maybe the journalism was reliable in that it quoted the sources. And so one thing that the New York Times prided itself on was, we're not going to lie to you ourselves, but we will quote any diplomat, anyone in the government who wants to lie to you. And so in that way, you know, they tried to still be reliable. They tried to not, you know, sort of be the yellow journalists, who, by the way, have a worse reputation than is deserved. The yellow journalists were also doing investigative reporting, but that's maybe another book and another time.
That sounds like a great book, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, so they tried to be reliable. They tried not to lie to their readers as much as possible, but oftentimes they knowingly would quote a government official telling a lie.
reporters are famously out there to get the scoop, to get there before any other reporters, and yet there was a homogeneity to the press corps as we look at the media in the 1940s.
Yes, there was a ton of cooperation. There were really strong friendships. And so something I look at are these crossed social professional networks and some of the clubs these men belong to and the very deep, real friendships they had for each other. But of course, it did make them a homogenous group. They made sure they remained exclusive. So that wasn't just, you know, no one that was too far to the right of them politically, no one that was too far to the left would be invited to some of these, you know, private off-the-record briefings, but also no women, no reporters of color. And there were a lot of reporters of color in the Capitol. There were strong black newspapers, and there were a lot of women reporters in the Capitol. But they weren't covering foreign policy. And that's one of the key issues to remember, especially when we're looking at U.S. foreign policy history and the sort of history of World War II and the Cold War, is that those voices were not in those rooms. And so there was actually less competition among these writers. Most of them were not directly competing with each other. So, you know, maybe two New York newspapers would be in competition. But the guy reporting for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is not really in competition with the guy reporting, you know, for the Chicago Daily News. And so those two could cooperate on stories. There's actually this practice even in the 1930s called black sheeting, where one of them would give the black carbon copy of his story to someone who had an editor far, far away who would never find out that the two guys had shared the same story. They stopped doing that in the 1940s, but it remained cozy and cooperative.
If we look at the news in the 1930s, when the United States was struggling with isolationism and staying out of entangling alliances in Europe, those stories having to do with foreign affairs would not be as, let's say, familiar to the people at home as would be a story about, I don't know, let's say corruption in Missouri or something. But foreign affairs also is the part of government that the executive branch has great power over. And so did that invite collusion between government and these reporters? The fact that, well, nobody's going to know if the ambassador to Albania says this or that.
I think there might have been some of that, of no one's going to find out, or the Home Office isn't going to find out. But they're also, you know, as you say, in the 30s, sort of less interest in foreign news, more interest in what was going on. Probably that remained the case, but there was a sense, at least, that people grew more interested in foreign news and sort of got a taste of our news during World War II. And so a lot of newspapers greatly expanded their foreign policy coverage in this period. And so we're getting a lot more of it, which is also sort of contributing to this idea of a Cold War consensus, even when there wasn't really one.
Well, speaking of consensus, do you have the sense when you look at these reporters from the 30s and 40s that they had a kind of a moral or political center to them, a point of reference that would possibly color the stories and the way they reported them?
Certainly, most of them were fairly liberal, sort of in a Roosevelt Democrat sense. A lot of them supported Roosevelt. A lot of their publishers did not. And the publishers back home would complain that they were writing stories that were too pro-New Deal or too pro-Roosevelt. And so that certainly sort of colored their outlook. It wasn't necessarily true across the board, but it was also true that, for example, the Chicago Tribune, which was quite conservative, would be cut out of some of the private dinners that the other reporters would have because, you know, they sort of were going against the grain of this liberal consensus that they were trying to create.
Did you ever get the sense that an administration, and I'll say FDR since that covers 12 years of the period we're talking about, that the administration actually tried to cut out any of the reporters or news sources that were not as sympathetic to their plans?
Certainly Franklin Roosevelt played favorites and sort of was well-liked by those who were in his orbit. The reporters and the newspapers that really got the brunt of FDR's dissatisfaction were black newspapers, because a lot of times the black newspapers were more openly critical of what the government was doing. This lasted into World War II. And I think if Roosevelt had had his way, he would have, you know, tried to shut down some of these newspapers, as had been done in World War I. So, you know, really resented some of the, you know, what he would have seen as agitation for equal rights coming from the black press.
What about Eleanor Roosevelt, though? Wasn't she a champion of those groups?
She was. She, in fact, started her own all-women's press conference. So a lot of women reporters came to Washington in the 1930s because suddenly their editors needed to have a woman reporter. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to cover the news that was coming from Eleanor Roosevelt's office. And she was sort of, you know, a big newsmaker in her own right. And so she was a big champion of women reporters who were sort of a strong cohort in the 1930s into the 1940s. And then that reversed very suddenly because of Bess Truman. Bess Truman did not want a relationship with the press. She did not want to have press conferences. When she found out she wouldn't have to have press conferences, she was elated. And so a lot of the women who had been able to cover politics during Eleanor Roosevelt's reign as First Lady were sort of sent back to the women's pages, you know, covering the four Fs: food, fashion, family, and furnishings.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt is often put number one in the list of influential First Ladies.
Yes, and made a big difference on the press.
Well, as we get into the 1930s, as we get toward World War II, Pearl Harbor, of course, December of 1941, is there unanimity among the press now? I mean, we're all Americans, we're all in this together, whatever our color, whatever our financial status.
So the press had been united, I think, a great deal more than the American people in general had been. Washington was an around-the-clock war capital, you know, starting in 1940. And so there was a sense of great urgency to get into the war, to be prepared. Some of the radio reports, especially those coming from Edward R. Murrow from London in, you know, 1939, 1940, into 41 before Pearl Harbor, actually had a really big effect on the American public and sort of paved the way for Americans to be more open to the idea of going to war on the side with Britain. Because, you know, the country, of course, wanted to stay out of the war. You know, sometimes that's called isolationism. And it's sort of a natural instinct, I think, for a lot of people. And that didn't go away suddenly during the war. I think that's one of our other misconceptions about this period, is suddenly everyone is great with international governance and everyone thinks that Britain is the best ally. It doesn't go away, but then, of course, with Pearl Harbor, there's no choice but to go to war. And so people do try to, including papers like the Chicago Tribune that had been so anti-Roosevelt, try a little bit more to get on board with the war.
Were they dealing with censorship of any kind? But, I mean, particularly having to do with government policies and goings-on behind the scenes?
Yeah, it was a really difficult period, which I think we forget. There was no formal censorship code, which actually made things even harder for reporters who would be overseas. They didn't know if their copy was going to be censored on the way home. The reporters didn't quite know what they were or weren't allowed to say. They didn't want to be the cause of aiding the enemy, and so they actually would have appreciated more guidance. So there's a lot of self-censorship. And then there was also just, you know, constant complaints from, you know, the top brass of the military to the top brass of the New York Times, you know, saying, you know, tell your reporter not to write about such and such. And then, of course, there was a lot of censorship around development of the atomic bomb.
Yes.
So the New York Times reporter who covered this, Bill Lawrence, he covered it so closely and is so closely identified with it. He's known as Atomic Bill Lawrence to distinguish him from a different political reporter, Bill Lawrence. So Atomic Bill, you know, knew all about what was going on with the development of the atomic weapon and, of course, sat on that story for years. He even went on loan to the government to help them write some press releases. Then went back to the Times and then covered those same press releases from the other side of it. And no one at the Times seemed to have a problem with this. There was a lot of reporters, men and women, in and out of the revolving door during World War II, quite understandably so, because people wanted to serve their country in some way.
A word or two about photojournalism and broadcast journalism at this time. Any difference? between those constraints and those of the print media?
So photojournalism was heavily censored, especially so as not to show Allied atrocities and not to show dead bodies of GIs. And at a certain point in the middle of the war, the Roosevelt administration lifted this ban, and Life magazine had very famous spread. I think a lot of people would maybe recognize of, you know, dead GIs on a beach.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people really appreciated that they were getting sort of that unvarnished account of the war. But in print, it certainly, you know, had not been that varnished. People were getting a fairly realistic portrayal. My students are always surprised when we read some of Ernie Pyle's dispatches.
Sure, famous
front,
column who died during the war.
Died during the war, and is showing like a very, you know, gritty, bleak side of the war. So it's not like Americans were getting a particularly rosy picture of the war, you know, before those photos came out. But it was certainly quite affecting when they did.
Then there was Bill Mauldin with his cartoons. It seems like an odd time to do cartoons, but very famous portrayals, at least of everyday life. I don't know if there were indications in his cartoons of serious downsides, but certainly some of the difficulties and strains of being in the war.
Certainly, you get a much more sense of the strenuousness of the war if you are reading newspapers at the time than if we're looking at some of the movies that got made in the same period.
We're going to look further at the phenomenon of journalism, news reporting in the 30s and 40s, and how different was it from what we have been experiencing in more recent years when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Catherine J. McGarr, and she's the author of City of Newsmen, subtitle of which is Public Lies and Professional Secrets in Cold War Washington. Leading up to the Cold War, of course, World War II, and the question is how unified were the members of the news pool, the press corps, during the 30s and into the 40s, and how in agreement were they with the government, the U.S. government? You've mentioned lies, of course, and so it's inevitable that we would get into some of those. World War II, the Roosevelt administration, again, we're all in this together. Is the Roosevelt administration lying to the press? I mean, I'm thinking a little bit about the time leading up to America's entry in the war, where no, we're not providing any, you know, ships or planes or anything to the Allies. And so I suppose that would qualify as a lie. Did the press know about that kind of thing?
The press certainly knew about it, and the press always knew the government was lying to them. Maybe not immediately, but certainly knew that the federal government and the president in particular were capable of lying to them. And I think if you actually go back into the coverage, you'll see sort of some clear-eyed reporting about that and about what was really going on behind the scenes. So again, they might quote the president saying one thing, but then maybe try to provide evidence to the contrary if the contrary was true. But there was a lot of tension, especially once the war started, because FDR really tried to close things down with the press. For example, early on, he took this train trip across America, and he wouldn't let any of the reporters come and cover it as he was going along. And the Washington Reporter said, "This is ridiculous. People are going to see you, and they're going to wonder why their paper didn't know you were coming to town." And so they started to organize a little bit better to try to get more information. But it wasn't really until they started instituting what they called these background dinners, where they started having social occasions with high-profile members of the government or of the military to get sort of off-the-record or secret information, that they felt like they at least were no longer being lied to. And they agreed that they wouldn't share any of the information that they got at these dinners, but it sort of gave them a sense of being in the know. And then they would write these secret memoranda back to their publishers and editors back home, and then they would have a sense of being in the know. And so that's where we sort of see the foundation for what in the 1950s is going to become a little bit more problematic as the lies get more blatant, especially under the Eisenhower administration, and as reporters want to collude less.
What sort of secrets in World War II and the years immediately following?
Well, a lot of it had to do with sort of the outlook of what is the United States' goal in the post-war world. And so a lot of reporters saw America's stance as somewhat hypocritical when we would complain about Britain's empire, but then we were certainly planning on taking over Britain's empire, or saying, you know, we're not going for a land grab after the war. You know, we're just taking every island in the Pacific and, you know, setting up permanent bases all over the place. And so maybe there's not, you know, particular lies where you can point to, oh, there's this smoking gun here. But there's certainly sort of an outlook that the government wanted reporters to adopt, that it was in reporters' best interest to adopt in print, partially to satisfy their readers.
Sell those papers.
Yeah. So one of my favorite letters I came across was one between Joseph Harsh, who's a prominent diplomatic correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. His papers are actually here at the Wisconsin Historical Society. And this prominent historian. And Harsh basically says, you know, if I wrote the truth as my colleagues and I all see it, I wouldn't have any readers and I wouldn't have a job, because the truth is often counter to American folklore. And, you know, what he meant by that was this American folklore that America are the good guys.
Yes.
And his, you know, firsthand knowledge that was not the case. And of course, America was playing power politics, and they all knew it.
So what did they see was America's goal, actually empire building? I mean, at least ostensibly, the U.S. gave the Philippines its independence in 1946 and, you know, dropped a few other potential colonies along the way. What did they see as America's goal then?
I think they saw what they would have said was saving Western Europe, saving civilization. And they sort of saw that as white civilization. So, you know, Western Europe was, of course, devastated, as a lot of the world was, after World War II. And a lot of these reporters had gone back and forth, especially to London, and, you know, even been there for part of the Blitz, and had a lot of affection and admiration for Western Europe. And so they sort of saw that Western alliance, and in particular the alliance with Britain and France, as some of the most important, you know, goals to hold on to that relationship in the post-war world. And that's, of course, at odds with the anti-colonialism that the U.S. government, you know, said it was in favor of, because our two closest allies were the ones who had the most colonies. And so there's a tension throughout. And what I see is a lot of reporters who want to support, for example, the Marshall Plan. So it was the plan for European recovery. They want to really provide a way for Western Europe to come back from World War II, and again, sort of save the cradle of Western civilization.
Sounds noble.
I think they thought that it was noble. I think they realized, of course, that maybe extracting resources from the colonies weren't necessarily in line with the democratic principles they were espousing. But they were also okay with that if, you know, that would help America have a strong military, be prepared for the next war, and most importantly, prevent World War III.
So once the atomic age began, of course,
right.
in 1945.
Right.
How did the Truman Doctrine play into this? Truman, of course, taking over from the deceased FDR in 1945, right at the war hasn't even ended in the Pacific yet. And how did they feel about atomic weapons?
So, you know, the Truman Doctrine says we will, you know, go try to save democracy. Everywhere democracy is under threat. And I was really surprised when I got into sort of these background papers of these reporters, how cynical they were about the Truman Doctrine from the beginning. And, you know, sort of putting democracy in quotation marks, for example. Like, yeah, we're spreading democracy. And one of the ways where you can really see some of the cynicism is at the Gridiron Dinner. So this is one of the clubs that sort of helps keep the elite reporters of Washington in close contact with each other and helps keep the space pretty exclusionary. It was an all-white men's dinner group, and at that time they met twice a year. They had a formal dinner, which was white tie and tails, and they had an informal dinner, which was just a tuxedo and a black tie.
Informal, of course.
Yes. And they would put on these skits, and the Gridiron Papers are at the Library of Congress, and so they have all of these skits. They were off the record, so there wasn't a lot of coverage at the time. And the skits, especially after the Truman Doctrine, you know, really poke fun at the idea that the United States is saving the world for democracy, and sort of that as an unrealistic and idealistic goal.
Well, the understandable perception from the outside, at least, would be, well, arguably, the United States tipped the balance of the war unwillingly by joining the war when, obviously, when attacked, and that the United States was helping to rebuild these democracies, the United States being intact and had the wherewithal to rebuild these democracies in Europe, but they weren't, the press wasn't buying into that as being the actual ultimate goal, according to the Truman Doctrine.
Well, in some place like Greece, they were pretty cynical. So Greece and Turkey were sort of the, you know, immediate beneficiaries of the Truman Doctrine. And it seemed to a lot of people, including a lot of members of the Washington press, that the U.S. government was simply sort of supporting a corrupt, rightist, you know, totalitarian type government in Greece. And of course, you know, we know now that they went on to do that a lot of places.
Iran,
Guatemala, yeah. And so members of the press would sort of have that as their opinion, but then sort of be straitjacketed a little bit into reporting a lot of the facts that the government, the U.S. government and the Greek government wanted published. But in terms of, you know, saving Western Europe, they were less cynical about Western Europe. They were less cynical about those, what they saw as like the existing democracies, the birthplaces of democracies. And they did think that getting the right resources, you know, back to Great Britain as being the place they had the most identification with would really save Great Britain.
How did the press play into Americanism versus communism, or democracy versus communism, as the Cold War ramps up? It seems like just like the day after the war ended.
I'm always surprised at how we think that, you know, there was this binary and it's, you know, communism or democracy, and all of the reporters all of a sudden, you know, bought into anti-communism. And I think one of the reasons maybe we think that or remember it is because Time magazine certainly had that view. Time magazine was, you know, cold warrior, and they were extremely stridently anti-communist. But Time magazine was really unimportant within Washington and among these reporters who were writing for these newspapers all over the country or writing for other magazines and reporting on foreign policy. They would, you know, rank Time magazine as like the lowest of what they trusted. And so when you actually get into the meat of some of these newspapers, you don't really see the Cold Warrior aspect. I mean, you see a lot of pushback actually against McCarthy, you know, well before
the extreme Cold Warrior.
Right. Well before the Murrow broadcast.
Sure.
And so you see a lot of non-ideological reporting. So again, it's more that they want the resources for Europe, or they want strong military for the United States. They seem to have very little to do or want to do with either communism or anti-communism, and it's really not part of that behind-the-scenes vocabulary that they have.
And yet there is somehow this groundswell of anti-communism, that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that would be where all these right-wing dictatorships would be patrons of the United States, but the press didn't see it that way, I gather.
And again, it's such the small slice of the press that doesn't see it that way. You know, it's these white men reporting on foreign policy. And so they are the ones who have the most to do with reporting on the so-called Cold War, right? They're reporting on foreign affairs. So there are certainly Cold Warriors. And I mentioned Joseph Alsop earlier as sort of the epitome of the Cold Warrior and, you know, an elite columnist. So there were people in the press and people across America, you know, writing for local newspapers, writing for the city newspapers and the metros across the country, who were, you know, legitimately believed in this Cold War anti-communist ideology. I just did not find that among this group of reporters who were really doing the brunt of the reporting on foreign affairs.
As we go from Harry Truman, the Democrat, to Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican, in 1953, do things change in terms of the press's attitude towards national policy?
Yeah, things get a lot worse. for reporters, anyway. So Truman has already sort of been going towards a little bit more state secrecy, right? And stamping things as top secret or confidential, making it a lot harder for reporters to get any information. And then Eisenhower, you know, issued the executive order that really leads to way overclassification. That, I mean, we're still a little bit dealing with that today. I think reporters who cover national security are still fairly frustrated over what gets classified as top secret or secret. And so Eisenhower really tries to make it so that there are, you know, no leaks in his government, makes it very hard to get information. He himself does not have a great working relationship with reporters. So it always seems like reporters kind of liked Truman personally, you know, and enjoyed his company.
And the common man.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, he enjoyed them. They enjoyed each other, you know, for the most part. There's always exceptions. And Eisenhower really, really didn't. They sort of saw him as, you know, this general who was above them and thought himself above them and only, you know, rubbed elbows with the other generals in the press, so meaning the publishers. So a lot of the publishers, especially the really prominent publishers like Arthur Sulzberger of the New York Times, he loved Eisenhower. And, you know, Eisenhower, I don't know if Eisenhower loved him, but he certainly needed him and would flatter him and ensured that the New York Times endorsed him for president twice, even though everyone on the staff of the New York Times wanted Stevenson. And so there's sort of a difference between the reporters on the ground and the publishers back home.
Well, Eisenhower did have a gift of dealing with people in a way that was to his advantage, but I mean, he clearly had a certain kind of a charm that went along with the strategizing and getting people to do what he needed them to do.
Yeah, he had a great media strategy, and he also was the first to bring televisions into the presidential press conferences, and the White House owned those tapes. And they could edit them however they wanted.
Oh, truly.
They ended up realizing that they were going to get in more trouble for editing them too much because a lot of the reporters who were there would have been taking very good notes and would know that that wasn't exactly what happened. But they partially brought in these cameras to go over the heads of these print reporters. They said they were going to bring their message directly to the American people and make sure that, you know, the print reporters didn't have as much power. And that sounds sort of like what we see today also.
It's justifiable. I mean, you could say, yes, if they hadn't edited them, then they could say, whatever the reporters say, this is what really happened during this press conference.
Yes. So Eisenhower, though, was also known for being fairly inarticulate and not very quick on his feet. And so they also sort of saw a lot of gaffes behind the scenes that didn't necessarily make it into the 15-minute nightly news segment that was going on at the time.
Well, that is a little bit of a sidebar here. If we go all the way back to FDR, for example, and carry it through Eisenhower, the press is known for making a point of not showing FDR, you know, getting into a wheelchair or being helped into a car. The only time that I can think of where it was actually made manifest was when FDR himself, in one of his last appearances, said, "I've been traveling all around the world, and forgive me if I'm seated for this presentation." But there was, would you just call it common courtesy at that point? Or what would be the meaning of it?
I think there was also a sense, at that time that the personal could be separated from the political. I think, you know, partially maybe the women's rights movement helped teach us that that is not the case and the personal is political is one of their slogans. But at the time, there was this sense that that it's not interfering with the job and it would not be in the public interest. They, you know, they talked a lot about the public interest. So they don't see themselves as necessarily protecting FDR so much as protecting the American people. And same for not reporting on affairs, you know, either Roosevelt's or Eisenhower's or Kennedy's.
Or Kennedy's. And as far as the attitude of the press toward the White House office in general and covers of these various gaffes or weaknesses, you might say, of the president's. I mean, it's at one point it's not just a courtesy. At one point, clearly, it's this person is losing some of his ability to lead.
Yes, and you know, some reporters did try to cover Eisenhower in that way. I mean, someone like Scotty Reston, who was the bureau chief for the New York Times in
Washington.
James Reston, yes. Who I think we now just remember as like, well, he was just in the pocket of everyone. But he was actually tried at least to be pretty critical of the people he covered, including Eisenhower. And then the publisher, who was sort of a mentor of his and sort of saw him sort of like as another son, Sulzberger, would write him and berate him and say like, oh, looks like you want to be an opinion columnist given the way you're talking. And, you know, can't you write something nice about Eisenhower? And so, you know, there was criticism and especially behind the scenes when Eisenhower was so ill and it looked like there was a chance that Nixon could become president if Eisenhower died in office. The whole editorial board, again, wanted Stevenson because of that, you know, because of this, because of Eisenhower was so ill and had been so ill.
And Stevenson presented himself well. He was, what, ambassador to the UN, I think?
Yeah, everyone. Like, I don't know if he was yet. Yeah, later on. He'd been governor of Illinois. And
yes. Did he run both times in 52 and 56
times.
Against?
Yeah. Yeah. My guys, or you know, the people I looked at, the reporters I looked at, all wanted Stevenson. So now I always have like a fondness in my heart for Stevenson. So I'm always a little sad. But yeah, he lost both times.
And the beat went on. And we're going to look at some of the specific reporters that my guest has been talking about and also carry this phenomenon of the news pool, the media, into the 60s when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Journalists were embarrassed by their own compliance, and many were now adversarial to the administration. In addition, they resented the fact the CIA had started asking reporters more often to lie. On May 11, 1961, Wally Duell, who'd been working at the CIA since 1954, wrote his son describing the public relations issue from the agency's standpoint. "We've been living, I won't say in a fool's paradise, but we've been living charmed lives all this time until now," Duell wrote, referring to the CIA. "Our immunity from exposure and attack has been partly luck, partly due to the laziness and lack of imagination of some editors and publishers, partly to self-restraint imposed by patriotism on the part of others, partly to trust in the old man," meaning Alan Dulles, "partly to the old man's skill in handling his public relations, and above all, to the fact that we've had a series of fantastic successes. We've had a few failures, too, but they either haven't amounted to much or we haven't been found out."
The word lie appears in our conversation for the first time in this conversation about the press as it was in the 1940s and going into the 50s. And that actually came from 1961, early in the Kennedy administration. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Catherine J. McGarr. And we're looking at that phenomenon of trusting the media, which we have this image, I think a lot of us, of And we have this image, a lot of us, of a media that was objective and truthful always back in the 1950s and into the 60s. But it was apparently never that way. And we know that it's certainly not always that way now. And we're looking at where things might have been even slightly different and maybe not finding much in the long run. It just seems to be more overt in terms of this relationship between the press and the government or their sources in general. And as we get through the Eisenhower years and into the early 1960s, this word lie comes up. Now, did the Eisenhower administration, so far as we know, actually ask reporters to tell lies to the public?
Frequently.
Frequently. How did the press feel about that?
Not great. Kind of lies? They were fairly antagonistic towards the government. So, you know, the problem started almost right away in the Eisenhower administration. He appointed John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, and his brother, Alan Dulles, pretty soon became director of the CIA. And so you have these two brothers running foreign policy. And Eisenhower was all about sort of covert operations, psychological warfare, campaigns carried out through the CIA, rather than sort of overt warfare, right? So almost immediately getting us out of Korea, but then carrying on all of these behind-the-scenes operations that were ostensibly secret, but that the press, of course, knew about, and that the Dulles brothers would tell the press about in these, you know, background dinners and off-the-record dinners, and then that put the press in a very awkward situation where they would have lost access to their sources and wouldn't have been invited by their peers to any future dinners if they broke any of these confidences, but then worrying that they weren't doing right by the American people. The outright lying seems to have started, the requests for the outright lying seems to have started around 1954. That's the year when there's, you know, the coup in Guatemala, that the United States was sort of backing the rightist forces there and trying to crush the leftists. And then there were also some minor events in the Cold War that maybe we don't remember now, but were a big deal at the time. So like this person, Otto John, who defected into East Germany, and the United States wanted to say, like, this is a communist plot, and he was kidnapped, no one would ever defect. And the press knew that was a lie, and this is when they start saying, will you please lie for us, and will you please say that he was kidnapped, not that he defected. And this starts a whole slew of really interesting memos between Scotty Rustin, the bureau chief for the New York Times, and the editors back home in New York. And then this is also the time where we really increase our operations in Indochina.
Yes, because the French lose at Diem Bien Phu in 1954. And then what are we going to do? Domino theory.
Yep. Well, what are we going to do is, you know, we're going to invest a lot of money and some men in Vietnam. And, you know, the quote that I opened my book with is Nixon, vice president, in 1954, you know, telling reporters that we're never going to be able to get out of Vietnam and it will always be bad. You know, like, this will go badly. We're never going to, you know, save it from communism. It will always be a problem for us, but we need to talk about it optimistically in public.
Nixon saying that.
Nixon said it, but of course it didn't make it into the paper. It only made it into these secret memos. And some of these memos, by the way, which were circulated in newsrooms, then got classified by the CIA when the CIA put them into their own papers. So the CIA is being very clear at the time with reporters about what is really going on, and then making sure that reporters, you know, don't say anything to anyone else. With Indochina also, you know, Rustin, for example, got the tip that we were not just sending planes, but that we were also sending pilots from unvouchered CIA funds. And he told the New York office and said, of course, it's up to you whether we can run this or not, knowing very well that the New York office was not going to run that because the government, of course, was maintaining its position that it was not, would not be sending pilots. You know, we think of the U.S. involvement on the ground in Vietnam as not coming until the 60s. Reporters knew that it was happening in the 50s, and they sort of kept it to themselves for national security reasons, and then drew this line in the sand over not overtly lying, just withholding from the American public.
It does seem surprising that out of all these reporters that not one of them leaked this news.
Well, there were people like I.F. Stone, who was reporting from outside these insular groups. He had his own newsletter, and he reported on all of these items. But in terms of anyone writing for mainstream white U.S. newspaper at this time. No one leaked because they would have gotten kicked out of these off-the-record and background briefings if they had, and never would have been invited back. So these are these dinners.
Would have been their last story. Big story, yeah. But their last story.
Right. They had jobs to do. I mean, we never should forget that, you know, the press in the United States is primarily a for-profit institution. These guys have a duty and usually daily deadlines. They have a duty to their readers, and they don't want to get fired. And so there are a lot of things besides upholding democracy that goes into reporters' decisions on a day-to-day basis.
We began just a few minutes ago with JFK, 1961, very early in his administration, having to do with lies. How did, in his all-too-brief tenure as president, how did JFK deal with lies? And certainly some came out after his administration.
Right. He had a more antagonistic relationship with the press than we remember. So there were some very high-profile friends in the press. I think the one that most people remember is Ben Bradley. And then Ben Bradley went on to live, you know, a very long life and became very famous. And so when we think of Kennedy, maybe we think of this great relationship with the press and with someone like Ben Bradley. But, you know, that was just one reporter. And so a lot of reporters had a fairly antagonistic relationship with this man.
How come?
Well, I secretly think that Reston partially didn't like him because he was having so many affairs. And Reston, like, really prided himself on this, like, you know, on his Presbyterianism and on, you know, always being faithful to your wife and supporting each other. And so I think partly he just didn't like him as a person, but also because Kennedy continued with the covert operations that Eisenhower had started. And so, you know, as soon as Kennedy got to office, there was the Bay of Pigs invasion planned. It was already underway, you know, invasion of Cuba and training Cuban rebels in Guatemala. And when Kennedy came into office, Allen Dulles was still head of the CIA. John Foster had died by that point. And, you know, they sort of went ahead with this operation, even though they were getting a lot of advice, including from reporters on the ground, that it was going to go very badly. And the story of what happened with the Bay of Pigs and the press gets misremembered in so many different ways. The New York Times actually did report on the Bay of Pigs invasion before it happened. What happened was they didn't say specifically CIA. They said the government was doing it, but they took out, at the CIA's request, they took out the name CIA. And so there's actually, it looks like there's very little reporting on the CIA in this period, because if you, you know, do a search for the terms CIA or Central Intelligence Agency, you'll get very little. But they still reported on it. They still reported on the coup in Guatemala. They're just never saying CIA. And so we have this memory of the New York Times sort of abdicating its responsibility and suppressing the news about the Bay of Pigs. But they didn't. They just took out the name of the CIA. They still said this is happening and this is going to go very badly. And so then, you know, Kennedy goes from berating them for publishing it to then a week later saying, well, if you'd published it more and better, maybe we could have saved us and we wouldn't have had this tragedy and it's your fault.
A little bit of finger pointing.
Yeah. So right from the beginning, Kennedy was not ingratiating himself. And he then went on immediately after that to lecture publishers at this big annual meeting that the publishers had, saying, you know, I just want you to think about not just whether it's news, but whether it's good for the country. And these publishers had been doing exactly that for many years.
Bad news can sometimes be good for the country.
And bad news can sometimes be good for the country. And so, yeah, I think that he had also a more strained relationship with the press than we sometimes remember from, like, the one-off relationships that he had.
Well, there's a newspaper headline that comes to mind. Kennedy wins stunning victory, having to do with the Cuban Missile Crisis when the Russians agree to pull their missiles out of Cuba. But it wasn't until 20 years later that the facts behind that came out, that it was actually not a one-sided victory at all, that it was a quid pro quo.
Right. I think that in that case, it seems from the, you know, memos behind the scenes, reporters saw that as very different from the Bay of Pigs. They had this big fear of nuclear war, rightly so. They saw that with the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States might have been on the brink of nuclear war and were very reluctant to do anything that might rock the boat. And so really sort of towed the government line on that reporting and felt good about their decision. So a lot of the memos I see in the files are they feel so guilty that they didn't say what the CIA was doing at such and such a time and when should we say this. But I didn't see a lot of hand-wringing over the Cuban Missile Crisis, which they held off on reporting until the government gave the go-ahead.
Well, in this antagonism between the press and the administrations does nothing but ramp up once we get into LBJ, the Vietnam War, and myriad other things which were leaked and reported on.
Right. And so the rest of the country gets a sense that the government was lying when we get the Pentagon Papers in 1971. But it wasn't a surprise to reporters. Reporters knew the government had been lying to them, you know, the entire time.
So bottom line here is that all along there was some antagonism, some skepticism, some cynicism in the press, even though we look back at it in a, like, sort of a clouded lens,
right,
and think that it was all kind of lockstep with a yes. single American value system in common with the government.
Right, which never quite made sense to me, because I don't know why we would think that entire generation of reporters that had lived through World War II was somehow so naive that they just, you know, automatically believed everything Alan Dulles told them. I mean, I think we need to give them a little more credit, maybe, as well as a little more blame and credit for, you know, not being government dupes and making a lot of difficult decisions.
Well, this is fascinating bind between reporting the truth and having access to the government that's making the news.
Right. And that's one of the reasons that someone like I.F. Stone, you know, Izzy Stone, writing from outside the government, does a better job at getting at the actual truth of what the government is doing. Same with black newspapers, who have a much franker assessment of what the United States government is doing overseas, partially because they don't have that access to lose. So you can do good reporting without access. It's just not the kind of reporting that these guys were doing.
Catherine J. Magar, quite an interesting look at the American news media then and more recently and by implication now. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Catherine J. Magar is a professor of journalism and mass communications at the UW-Madison and author of City of Newsmen, Public Lies and Professional Secrets in Cold War Washington, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2022. Our engineer is Jeff Robbins. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air.